This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome back to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be a crime special on the Ipswich prostitute murder trial. I am joined by senior barrister Simon Spence QC, from Red Lion Chambers in London. Simon has successfully prosecuted and defended numerous very high profile complex murder cases and non-fatal violent offences for many years. He has extensive experience in the courtroom in sensitive and difficult sexual offence cases with a particular emphasis on child and vulnerable witnesses. Simon, thank you ever so much for joining me today.
Pleasure. Nice to be here with you, Hattie.
Yes, so the Ipswich prostitute murder trial. When you brought this up when we did our last podcast, Simon, you said, oh, you know, I defended on that. I was part of the prosecution. I got it the wrong way around. There you go. Let's just start with that. I thought, oh, yes, please. We'd love to have a chat about that. And just to give our listeners what the Ipswich prostitute murder trial, a little bit of background on that. In January 2008, a forklift truck driver, 49-year-old Steve Gerald James Wright, appeared in Ipswich Crown Court accused of murdering five prostitutes during a killing spree carried out over a pace never seen before in Britain and over a 10-day period in December 2006. The five murders led to one of the country's biggest ever manhunts and drew comparisons with the infamous 19th century killer, Jack the Ripper. It threw a spotlight on the murky world of drugs and illicit sex. Steve Wright denied the killings. Gemma Adams, Tanya Nicole, Anneli Alderton, Paula Clennell, and Annette Nichols, whose naked bodies were found dumped at rural locations around the eastern town of Ipswich in Suffolk. Grim, very grim. But let's talk about the interesting side of this and what happened. So tell us, Simon, what were your initial thoughts when you were instructed on the case? And what was your role as the prosecuting barrister?
I was instructed quite early on in the case, once it became apparent that this was, in all likelihood, the work of a very fast-moving serial killer. The prosecution, once that identified Steve Wright as a suspect, wanted to be getting advice from an independent barrister. I, at that time, of course, was still a junior barrister. It was this case that enabled me to apply to become a QC or a senior barrister. And because I live in Suffolk, I appeared to be the choice that they came to take on the case. It couldn't be assumed, of course, that it was all the work of the same person. This is always one of the problems with serial killer investigations. You can't assume that it's one person until you've got enough identifying features in the evidence to lead you to a sure conclusion that it is the same person. And early on in the investigation, all the police had was one DNA match on one of the bodies of the girls, which matched Steve Wright. Now, bearing in mind what they did for a living and bearing in mind the likelihood that he may have been an innocent customer of theirs, then that possibility had to be excluded. And so it was quite a tough call between, on the one hand, charging him once there was enough evidence, but also making sure that by the time he was charged, we had enough evidence to show that he was responsible for all five deaths. And of course, the forensic investigation was massive and continued well beyond he was the date that he was charged. And so it was a bit of a gamble, to be honest, and one that the Crown Prosecution Service and the police took before I was instructed in the case, but one that actually turned out to be the right call.
Yes, no, indeed. I mean, I hear what you're saying. So here you are saying, you know, being told, come on, let's have you on board here to prosecute this case, help us prosecute this case. But there wasn't really that much evidence at that stage. It was all in the process of being gathered and put together. Absolutely. In order to say to you, look, you've got a goal, you've got a winner here, you've got a golden ticket here. This one that is going to be quite easy for you because we've got all the evidence that we need.
Eventually, that's right. But of course, the other aspect to it is that there was massive political pressure, and that's political with a little p, on both the police and the CPS, because the impact of what Steve Wright was doing in the community in Ipswich, it wasn't just amongst the sex worker community. Every woman in Ipswich was living a life of dread. And that sounds quite an extreme thing to say, but it's true, because nobody knew when he was going to strike next. And of course, it was only as the picture started to emerge that it was apparent he was targeting sex workers and not just any women who he came across.
No, I hear you. So, I mean, how long did you spend preparing for it? I still think that, okay, so he carried out the murders November, December 2006, and then 2008. So that's, you know, 2 years later, it was in court.
Well, it was just after a year, actually, because it was the very end of 2006 that the girl started missing.
Yep.
And the trial was at the very beginning of 2008. And I spent most of 2007 working on this case. Obviously, as an independent barrister, you've got a practice to maintain, and I couldn't devote myself exclusively to this one case. And of course, it wasn't just me. There was a team of three barristers. I was led by a senior Treasury counsel from the Old Bailey, but he was, of course, extremely busy in London as well. So the brunt of the preparation of the case fell on my shoulders. And we also had the luxury of another junior barrister who dealt purely with disclosure of what's called unused material. So in other words, material that the police had uncovered during the course of the investigation, which needed reviewing carefully to see whether it had any potential relevance or not. And one of the difficulties with inquiries such as this is it does, I'm afraid, attract some of the lunatic fringe, people who, in a bizarre way, want to be associated with it, even though they have nothing to do with it.
Really?
There was quite a bit of that going on. Not dissimilar with, remember with the Peter Sutcliffe case, the police lost a lot of time investigating an audio recording that they were sent, which turned out to be a complete hoax. And there was a bit of that going on with Steve Wright as well. So we had to sort the wheat from the chaff and focus on what was important.
What needed doing and what didn't. You had Timothy Landau QC as one of the barristers defending Steve Wright on the other side. Was he the lead QC? Was he leading?
He was. He was the lead QC, and his junior at the time was a contemporary of mine called Mark Fennells, who equally is now a QC and is vice chairman of the criminal of the Bar Council. So we've all aged and come on quite a long way since then.
Okay, so I mean, the jury heard evidence in this case that Wright's DNA was found eventually on three women's bodies. Distinctive fibres from his clothes, home and car were found on all five women. And it was quite grim. I mean, two of the bodies were laid out in a cruciform shape. What were the key points of evidence against Wright in this case that, you know, gave you a successful prosecution at the very end?
Bearing in mind how quickly they all went missing, but equally for some of them, Tanya Nicol, for example, how long it was before her body was found, we weren't at all hopeful that we'd get independent forensic evidence in relation to each individual girl. But in fact, we did, which was quite remarkable. Two of the girls, Tanya Nicol and Gemma Adams, were found deposited in water. One was found at Cop Dock, the other was found at Hintlesham. And of course, when a body is immersed in water, the effect of loss of forensic evidence is much quicker because the body deteriorates and the skin disintegrates far more quickly. The other three, Annalee Alderton, Annette Nichols and Paula Clennell, were all found not far from each other, in fact, in the Nacton area of Ipswich. Annalee and Annette were, as you say, laid out in a cruciform shape. All of them were found naked, and quite why they were laid out in this way, we never really understood. There's quite a famous surrealist painting by Max Ernst of a naked woman in a cruciform shape. And we did wonder whether that had something to do with it, but it turned out that it didn't. Paula Clennell was literally found dumped. And we think in her case, there was a passing motorist who disturbed Wright. And so whilst the belief was he was going to lay her out in the same way as the other two, because he was
disturbed, and he didn't have time. Yes.
Dumped the body and fled. So there was a system that he adopted. But one of the very unusual features of this case, certainly when one looks back at the history of the murders of prostitutes, is that there was no violence beyond actually killing them. And we could never have fully established the cause of death satisfactorily.
Wow. There was
gratuitous violence. And when one looks back at Jack the Ripper, for example, or Peter Sutcliffe, who are perhaps the two other primary serial killers of prostitutes or sex workers, both of them inflicted quite horrific injuries to their victims. Steve Wright didn't do that. He killed them, clearly, but there was no gratuitous violence. He was nicknamed the Suffolk Strangler, but actually there was no evidence that any of them were strangled.
So how were they, what would the outcome in terms of the cause of deaths?
Well, some of them were unascertained. We had the same pathologist, a very experienced pathologist called Dr. Nathaniel Carey, who conducted the post-mortem examinations on all of them. And certainly in relation to Tanya and Gemma, who were found in water, we couldn't say with any certainty what the cause of death was, beyond the fact that the circumstances in which they were found clearly indicated the involvement of a third party.
Oh, wow.
And so it, from that perspective, forensically, as far as the pathology is concerned, it was very interesting indeed, because they may have been asphyxiated, suffocated, but there weren't the classic marks around the neck of manual strangulation or ligature strangulation, which is why Suffolk Strangler, although it was a nickname that the media picked up on, was something of a misnomer, because we couldn't say that's what he'd done to them.
Right. Goodness gracious. And what was the final outcome of the case, Simon? What was he charged with eventually, and what sentence did he receive?
He was charged with five separate counts of murder, one in relation to each girl. This was always a case where it was either going to be murder or nothing. His defence was that he had nothing to do with the deaths of these girls.
Because he admitted actually having sexual intercourse with all of them, didn't he? He just said...
He admitted using them for sex. He was interviewed for hours and hours and made no comment throughout. So his defence came quite late in the day. And unsurprisingly, given the nature of their work, his defence was, well, I was an innocent customer of theirs, and it's just a very unfortunate coincidence that shortly after I had sex with them, and that's how my forensic evidence came to be left on them, somebody else turned up and killed them. The difficulty with that defence, of course, is that it meant that whoever it was, if it wasn't Steve Wright, was finding these girls shortly after he'd had sex with them and killing them in the order in which he had had sex with them, which is a pretty unlikely scenario when you...
Yes, particularly you get to number three, number four, then number five.
Precisely.
Goodness, yes.
And that was really the force of our case, leaving aside the forensic evidence we had in relation to each of them. It was the unlikelihood of that having happened. And so actually, after a 5.5-6 week trial, the jury were only in retirement for, I think, about 2.5 days. And they convicted him unanimously of all five murders.
You said that the jury were only retired for 2.5 days. In cases like this, and obviously this is an unusual case. It's not something that we see, thank goodness, every year or every few years. But what is there a figure that could be put on the average time that a jury will go out and deliberate for? Is 2.5 days, for example, short compared to the scale of this case and the length of time they had to hear evidence, prosecution and defence? What would be a standard? What would have been the expected time, for example? I mean, it's hard to say, but...
It is. It depends on the complexity of the issues in the case. You know, some trials can last a very, very long time. But the fundamental issue that the jury has to determine is quite a simple one. In other cases, even relatively short cases, there can be a lot that they have to think about. Here, it really was the forensic evidence and what short conclusions they could draw from it. I think everyone involved in the case expected the jury to take longer than they did. And I think the speed with which they returned their verdicts perhaps reflects the strength of the forensic evidence that there was available and the unlikelihood of his defence being a true one.
Yes, no, indeed. So, well, I mean, if they everybody heard what went on in that courtroom and they go off and deliberate, and as you say, deliberations, sometimes you hear that they can go on for weeks and then you hear that they go on for hours. So I should imagine that, you know, the prosecution was very strong, obviously, in this case. So what sentence did he get, Simon?
He received a mandatory life sentence. Anybody convicted of any murder has to get a life sentence under English law. What normally happens is that the judge will then set a minimum period that the defendant has to serve before he becomes eligible for parole. So it is possible for somebody convicted of murder and given a life sentence to actually at some stage be released. Having said which, in cases of multiple murder such as this, there is provision for a judge to make a finding that a defendant is so dangerous that and his crimes are so heinous that they should never be considered for parole, what's called a whole life order. And that is what the trial judge imposed on Steve Wright. There aren't actually that many people convicted of murder in this country serving whole life orders. Harold Shipman was sentenced to a whole life order. Rosemary West was. There are some others, but Steve Wright received a whole life order, so he will never be released.
I was going to say that can't in any shape or form be challenged then. Sometimes, you know, you hear people challenging and appealing, and this just can't be. It's not open for that. In layman's terms, he can't challenge his sentence in any shape or form.
No, he tried to appeal his conviction, but then abandoned his appeal a couple of years after he launched it. He never actually sought to appeal his sentence. And I think that was probably because when you're convicted of five quite gruesome murders, even though he didn't violate the bodies, they were still terrible murders. And when you've committed five of them, it would be obvious to anybody, I'd have thought, whatever advice they receive, that they're never going to be released.
Yes, no, indeed. And so they shouldn't be released, to be honest with you. Let's talk about the impact. I know you mentioned that every woman in Ipswich, you know, was really fearful for their lives during this period of when these deaths had been uncovered in December and up until a year later when he was actually in trial. What impact did the case have on the local area, would you say, Simon?
At the time, the impact was massive, and not just Ipswich, but all of Suffolk, because it's a largely rural county. It doesn't have a particularly high crime rate compared to other places. And this was really quite startling behaviour. And it certainly had a huge impact on all the community, but particularly amongst women in Ipswich and the surrounding area. One thing it did do, which, and that this has been a permanent ongoing impact of this case, I think, is that it has taken the sex industry off the streets of Ipswich and moved it indoors. Now, the police know, and they knew at the time, that there were sex workers working in Ipswich, and there was a...
It was referred to as a red light district area.
Yes. And of course, the irony of this case is that the courthouse in Ipswich is just by the football ground, and that area of Ipswich was...
The red light district, so to
speak. Being the red light district.
Yeah, goodness.
And of course, Steve Wright lived on London Road, which was at the other side of the red light district from where the football ground and the courthouse is. The impact is that whilst I am sure that there are still sex workers working in Ipswich, they're not walking the streets. And that is clearly something which the police and that community have agreed amongst themselves, that the police perhaps to some degree turn a blind eye to it, as long as the sex workers themselves are safe, as long as there's no question of exploitation.
Yes.
And that they are safe from attack. And that, I think, is an ongoing consequence of this case. A number of the families, because one of the other roles I had during the trial was liaising with, together with the police liaison officers, with the families of these girls, not all of whom were aware of the lives they were leading. And they set up a charity called Someone's Daughter, just to remind people that however much they might disapprove of the way these women were earning their livings, they were still someone's daughter.
Yes, indeed.
And that charity picked up quite a lot of momentum in the months and years after the case. And so that too, I think, is a good thing, because however much one may approve or disapprove of how these girls were living their lives, the reality is, I remember overhearing a journalist, actually, who was quite perceptive in the courthouse, saying, this isn't a case about sex, it's about drugs. Because all of these girls, to some degree, had their lives blighted by drugs, which they'd been introduced to by other people. And this was their way of paying for their habit.
Wow.
And so actually, that journalist was absolutely spot on. It wasn't a case about sex. It was a case about drugs and the way these poor girls were driven to live the lives that they were living in order to fund the habits that others had got them involved.
Addiction. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's an aspect of the case that got very little publicity. And of course, the inevitable way in which the media report cases like this is... The sort of rather more lurid aspect of what they were doing and what Steve Wright was up to. But behind it lay five very sad personal stories. And that was something which
Indeed.
Was really brought home to me, having dealt with the families of these girls, and particularly those who were completely unaware of what was happening.
No, indeed. And what an insight. I have to say that is tremendously insightful and interesting to hear. Simon, that's all we've got time for, but thank you ever so much. And I'm going to drag you back in and say, right, what's the next murder trial we're going to cover? What's the next criminal trial we can cover? But thank you so much for your time today. That's incredibly interesting to hear.
Thank you very much, Katie.
And what I'll say to our listeners is don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcast. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.